And I think the only thing we can say is that one thing Trump understood is that we were not having the liberal-conservative argument anymore. That was over the size of the state, socialism versus capitalism. That was the market versus the state. But he understood that the argument has changed. It's not that. It's now it's just open, closed. If you have the tailwinds of globalization and the meritocracy pushing behind you, you're for open borders, open trade, open social mores. If you're getting blasted in the face by those things, you want to close borders, close social mores, build walls.
That's David Brooks, and this is a broadcast from the 2018-2019 President's Lecture Series at the University of Montana, Missoula. David Brooks has worn several journalistic hats over his career: reporter, editor, political and cultural commentator, and in recent years, best-selling author. Adding historical perspective to his view of the U.S. in the Trump era, Brooks says, quote, "We have a culture that works for us for a time, then it stops working and they chop it up. It was the same problem in 1848 or 1905 or 1968. Those are really bumpy moments as we chop up the old order, but people are ingenious," unquote. David Brooks is a columnist for the New York Times and a commentator on the PBS NewsHour, NPR's All Things Considered, and NBC's Meet the Press. He is the author of Bobos in Paradise, The New Upper Class and How They Got There, and The Social Animal, The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement. His fourth and most recent book is The Road to Character. Brooks teaches at Yale University and is a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. David Brooks presented The Cultural Revolution We Need on September 10th, 2018 at the Wilma Theater in Missoula.
Okay, we're done here. I'm happy. It is true, Montana is my favorite state, and this is my favorite part. I say that no matter where I am, except in Wyoming. I say Wyoming. I told the group earlier today at the university that my father was a college professor, taught at NYU, and when I was 12, he was moving on. He got two job offers, which he seriously considered. One of them was at a school outside of Philadelphia, and the other was at Montana State in Bozeman. And he chose the school outside of Philadelphia, but has left this shadow in my life of who I would be if I'd come here. I think I'd be like 6'3". I'd be like strapping, you know, throwing moose around or whatever, having sensitive moments on the river, all that kind of stuff. It is a great pleasure to be here, and I'm going to come back and do more fishing next time. Now, I am, by reputation and by fact, somewhat of a bookish person. And so when I was 7, I read a book called Paddington the Bear. And at that moment, I decided I wanted to become a writer. And so books have been my life ever since then. I remember in high school, I wanted to date a woman named Bernice, and she didn't want to date me, she wanted to date some other guy. And I remember thinking, what is she thinking? I write way better than that guy. And so that would have been a difference of values. And then I went to a bookish college. The admissions officers at Wesleyan, Brown, and Columbia decided I should go to the University of Chicago. The famous saying about Chicago, no longer true, where fun goes to die. The more accurate one is it's a Baptist school where atheist professors teach Jewish students St. Thomas Aquinas. And so that's, we did attract Norman McLean, though, to be fair. And so I went to Chicago. I was a double major. I majored in history and celibacy. I teach now at Yale because I only teach at schools I couldn't have gotten into. My students are amazing. Like, I was nothing like that. You ask them, what are you doing on spring break? It's, yeah, I'm going to unicycle across Thailand while reading to lepers. They're doing all that stuff. But I did learn some skills, how to dominate classroom discussion while doing none of the readings. I managed a fighter called the Kosher Killer, a boxer. And we decided to do it the University of Chicago way. We didn't actually practice boxing. We just read books about boxing. And we entered him in the Chicago Golden Gloves. Is true, and he, because of a series of health issues with the other fighters, he got a series of byes up to the semifinals. And so he came out, he'd never boxed in his life, just with his arms swinging like this. The other fighter had never seen anything like this. He shot back into his corner, and then 92 seconds in, realized, well, one uppercut ends this, which is what happened. So let's say I'm bookish, I'm on TV, which is usually a visual medium unless you're on the NewsHour. And we're sort of even bookish there. What we do this segment called Shields and Brooks. We wanted to call it Brooks Shields, that would have been better. I think Mark has been here, and some of you may know it's now called Shields and Brooks. Before that it was Shields and Chigo, and before that it was Shields and Gergen, and then before that it was Shields and Coolidge, I think. Mark has been doing it for a while. Now our show is, I love being on the show. We have a certain demographic. So if a 93-year-old lady comes up to me in the airport, I know what she's gonna say. She's gonna say, I don't watch your show, but my mother loves it. And so, it's always good to be super big in the hospice community. So that's sort of bookish, and then I write a column at the New York Times. I'm the conservative columnist at the Times, a job I liken to being chief rabbi at Mecca, not a lot of company a lot of the times. And so again, more writing, just writing. Though I think as you get older, you get a little more feminine in your taste if you're a guy. I think you let your emotions go, so I read more emotional books now. I'm the only American man who finished that book, Eat, Pray, Love, if you remember that book. By page 123, I was actually lactating, which was interesting. And then about 8 years ago, I wrote a book on emotion called The Social Animal, and all my friends joke that me writing a book about emotion is like Gandhi writing about gluttony. It's like not what I knew about. And then just recently, I wrote a book on character called The Road to Character. And writing that book, I learned that writing a book on character doesn't actually give you good character. And even reading a book on character doesn't give you good character. But buying a book on character does give you good character, so I recommend that. And so all this to say is I'm bookish, and I do a lot of my life up here. But even I have to recognize that the thinking, the rational brain, is the third most important part of our consciousness. And the first is the desiring heart, the things we love. I read about a guy recently who bought a house with a driveway and it had a bamboo stand nearby, and he hated bamboo. So he took an axe and he chopped down the bamboo, then he dug a hole and chopped up the root system, what was left of the bamboo, then he poured plant poison over everything, then he put 3 feet of gravel in the hole, and then he covered it over with concrete. And 2 years later, little stick of bamboo shooting up. And in my view, we all have that. We are existential sharks. We all have our desires. And what we desire most is love. And love forms us. There were these orphanages in the 1950s where the doctors gave the children, these little infants, food and good health care, but they didn't want to have them spread germs, so they did not physically touch them. The mortality rate at age 2 was 38%, because it's the actual touch, the loving touch that wires the fibers of the brain together. There's a great study called the Grant Study that took a bunch of men from 1940s to their deaths and studied all their lives. The biggest predictor of success in life was not IQ or social position, it was coming from a loving home. The men who had no deep love in their home were 3 times more likely to suffer mental illness, 2.5 times more likely to suffer dementia in old age, and made 50% less money over the course of their careers. Some of these men went into the army in World War II, many of them did, and some rose to become generals or majors or colonels, some stayed privates. And so they wanted to know what correlated with success in the army. It wasn't IQ, it wasn't social status, it wasn't even physical courage, it was relationship with mother. And the men who had mothers who'd poured love into them knew how to pour love into their men, and they were good officers. So we're defined by what we love. And sometimes love strikes with amazing speed. I was in Houston, where my wife used to live, and came across a guy who describes this woman, a concert pianist, who was about to move to San Francisco to be with her fiancé. And she decided, before I go, I'll get my hair done. So she went into this salon called Etude de Paris, and she looked over a guy cutting hair, and she went back to the back of the salon, put on her gown, called her mother, and said, I've just seen the man I'm actually gonna marry. So she gets her shampoo, and then she's sitting in the chair, and she asks the guy's name. His name is David, who told me the story. And he's asking her life story, and she says, well, I'm a concert pianist. I'm about to move to San Francisco to be with my fiancé, but I won't go if you'll marry me. And so David, as he tells the story, he looked at his scissors and he said, I never felt more free than I did at that instant. And he said, it's a deal. And they've been married for 17 years now. And so love can sometimes strike quickly, sometimes slow, really. But what the heart really desires is fusion with another. The kind of fusion that Louis de Bernier described in a great novel called Captain Corelli's Mandolin. And in that novel, there's an old guy talking to his daughter about his late wife. And he says to her, love is itself is what is left over when being in love is burned away. And this is both an art and a fortunate accident. Your mother and I had it. We had roots that grew toward each other underground, and when all the pretty blossoms had fallen from our branches, we found out that we were one tree and not two. And I think that's what we're all yearning for, that kind of just lifelong fusion with another person that we love. So that's the first most important part of our consciousness. The second is the yearning soul. I don't ask you to believe in God or not believe in God, that's not my department. But I do ask you to believe that you have a soul, that there's some place that has no shape, size, or color, but is of infinite value and dignity. Rich and successful people don't have more of this than the rest of us. Older people don't have more than younger people. Slavery is wrong because it's an indignation on another human being's soul. Rape is wrong because rape is not just an attack on a bunch of physical molecules, it covers over another person's soul. Obscenity is anything that covers over a soul. And what this soul does is it yearns for righteousness. We all want to lead good lives. I've covered murder crime, I've covered wars, I've met people who've committed horrible acts. But I've never met anyone who did not want to be good. And when we meet somebody, I was talking about at afternoon session today, when we meet somebody who is good, we see someone who just radiates with joy. They just have an inner light. I was saying that I met the Dalai Lama, and he just laughs for no reason at all. He just starts laughing. And you want to be polite, so you laugh, and he laughs, and you laugh. And I notice this phenomenon with a lot of people's lives. They get out of school and they think they're gonna climb their mountain, like their mountain is their career, building a family. And they get to the top of their mountain and it's kind of unsatisfying. Or maybe they get knocked off their mountain by failure or by something terrible and they're down in the valley. And down in the valley, they actually see that that first mountain was not really the satisfying mountain they wanted to climb. There's a second mountain ahead of them. And if the first mountain is self-centered and building up the ego and building up the identity, the second mountain is about pouring forth into community, into love, into other people. And I see many lives. I met a guy who was a banker in North Carolina. Banking was fine, but somehow it didn't satisfy him. And now he's helping young men transition out of prison. And he radiates with that kind of inner joy. And the weird thing about this, the soul, is that it's very powerful. This yearning for goodness is very powerful, but it's reclusive. You can go years in your life and not really think about it. And so I think of it like a reclusive mountain cat or a leopard, something that's up in the hills. And you go through your life, and it's up in the mountains a lot, and you barely glimpse it through the trees. Sometimes you have one of those horrible anxiety-ridden nights when you're really suffering, and you wake up at 2 a.m. with, as a poet said it, with your thoughts like a drawer full of knives. And in that vulnerability, you sort of hear the rumbling of the soul. And then there are fantastic moments when you're just filled with rapture and gratitude for existence and you feel the swell of it. But I think there are also moments, maybe later in life, when the leopard comes out of the hills and it sits in the room in front of you and asks you the fundamental questions. What good have you done? What is your purpose? Where do you derive meaning in your life? And for those who haven't thought about those questions, they have to live with that fact. But I think we all, at one point or another, our lives fall apart unless we have answers to those questions. And I've emphasized the heart and the soul because sometimes our public social sciences, sometimes our public discussion, sometimes our political talk, we treat it like we're just self-interested brains who are only out for our own good. that we're only interested in money and status and power. But we are whole people. And we have divorced from that, and sometimes a lot of our errors come from not appreciating how a whole person operates rather than just a brain or a body. Now, one of the things that whole people do is they create collective cultures, they create systems of relationship to solve their problems. And the culture of any given moment is a collective response to the problems of that moment. And I'm going to talk about a few cultures in our nation's past. The first one is from 1932 to 1968. This was a time that when they faced depression, World War, and this was a very group-oriented culture. Big organizations, the Army, the labor unions, IBM. The ethos was, we're all in this together. If you lived on, say, on Chicago's South Side, where I went to school, you probably followed your father and grandfather into the Nabisco plant. You joined the same union. There were no TVs then and no air conditioning. So in the summertime, the doors were left open and the kids were running from home to home, and you had really tight communities. People were in coffee clutches, babysitting co-ops, trading household goods. If somebody asked you where you were from, you didn't say, I'm from Chicago. You said, I'm from 59th and Pulaski, because the corner was what really mattered. And if you wanted to get ahead in the world, you joined a big organization and you rose up the hierarchy. There was a guy named John Ferry who served as a Democrat in the Illinois state legislator, and he was rewarded by his boss, Boss Daley, with a term in Congress. And he was asked how he would vote, and he replied, I will go to Washington to represent Mayor Daley. For 21 years, I represented the mayor in the legislature, and he was always right. And so that's deference to authority. And that has a lot of good features. Has close friendships, tight families, good communities. But that culture tolerated a lot of weakness, a lot of racism, sexism, anti-Semitism, emotional coldness, boring food. And so people chopped it up. And they wanted a more individualistic culture. And we had a shift in culture. And to me, that shift was symbolized by a moment in my childhood, Super Bowl III. And that was about 1969, 1970. Two great quarterbacks faced each other who grew up in basically the same area of Western Pennsylvania. On one side was a 1950s guy, Johnny Unitas. Crew cut, high top shoes, boring as the day is long. Good quarterback, but played like a plumber, doing his job well. Across the field was another guy named Joe Namath. He was a swinger, long hair, $5,000 fur coats, posed for pantyhose ads. He wrote a memoir called I Can't Wait Until Tomorrow Because I Get Better Looking Every Day. Johnny Unitas would not have written that memoir. And so there was a shift in culture. What was cool now was to be young, not old, expressive, not reticent, casual, not formal, rebel, not a conformist. It was an individualistic culture. And it was all about individual liberation, to be liberated from dogma, local opinion. And that individualism, that freedom, gave us a lot of good things. Gave us the civil rights movement, feminism, the peace movement, Age of Aquarius. I don't think we could have had Silicon Valley and all the whole rebel culture unless we'd had that movement, that rebellious attitude. It gave us some bad things too. A sharp rise in narcissism, a sharp rise in the desire for fame, and some downsides. If you take any true idea, it becomes false if you take it to an extreme. And we've had a pretty good run of individualism over the last 40 or 50 years. And it's left us with three overlapping crises. The first is a crisis of isolation. In 1980, 20% of Americans reported feeling lonely. Now twice as many do. A generation ago, only 8% of Americans lived alone. Now 30% do. In 1970, married couples entertained in their home an average of 15 times a year. Now it's 8. Only 8% of Americans report having important conversations with their neighbors. The fastest growing political party is unaffiliated. The fastest growing religious movement is unaffiliated. Suicides have been rising since 1999 and are now at a 30-year high. And then 55,000 people die every year of opiate addiction. And suicide is just a proxy for loneliness, and so is opiate addiction. The second is an institutional crisis of distrust, a loss of faith in each other. If you asked people a generation ago, do you trust the people around you? majority, 60% said, yeah, I trust the people around me. The people around me are trustworthy. Now it's down to 32% and 19% of millennials. The younger you go, the more distrustful people are. And that's not perception, that's reality. People are less trustworthy. It's their behavior. The third problem is a crisis of meaning, a crisis of purpose. It's amazing to me that mental health problems are rising, not falling. Depression rates are rising, not falling. I see it in my students. They get out of college, they have a setback, and it hits them hard. Nietzsche says, he who has a why to live for can endure anyhow. But if you don't know what your purpose is, then when you have the setbacks, you crumble. And I see that moral hunger and a moral vacuum in student after student. And so these three overlapping crises produce a fourth crisis, which is a reaction to the first. When you leave human beings naked and alone, they revert, they do what their evolutionary roots tell them to do, which is they revert to tribe. Tribalism is an attempt to cure the loss of community, but it's an attempt to do it through hatred and not through love and affection. Tribalism is a scarcity mentality. Tribalism is based on friend-enemy distinctions, us-them barriers. It's a warrior mentality. Politics is war, ideas are combats, society is tribal, we need to build wars, erect barriers. It's not based on love of your own side, it's based on hatred of the other side. And that populism is the rising thing we see in the country. I lived in Europe for the 1990s, and I covered a lot of great events for the Wall Street Journal. I covered the fall of the Berlin Wall, the end of the Soviet Union, Mandela coming out of prison in South Africa, the Oslo peace process in the Middle East. I covered one event that wasn't as good and was terrible. It was the Yugoslav Civil War. In retrospect, 25 years later, I realized that event was actually the most important event I covered because it predicted the rise of tribalism, the rise of nationalism, the rise of populism that has happened across the world ever since. And so these things, these movements are surging. I spent an afternoon not long ago with Steve Bannon. It was fascinating, actually. It was like being with Trotsky in 1905. And he just had a diagnosis that diverse societies would not succeed, and that he has this global international, he has a 100-year plan, Trump is only a piece of the plan, and he has coherence. He has coherence to his belief system. And maybe that is one future. Maybe we'll go from the period of we're all in this together to the individualistic period of I'm free to be myself, and maybe the next period will be revert to tribe. It looks that way now. But I will say there's another thing that is coming along, which is changing culture, and changing culture in a much better way. How do cultures change? They change often when a group of people, maybe not in the spotlight, find a better way to live, and everybody else wants to copy them. And so, over the last 6 or 7 months, I've been working with the Aspen Institute on a project called Weave the Social Fabric Initiative. And we travel around the world, and the whole idea is based on this social fragmentation is our core problem. And we travel around the world under the belief that the answer to that problem is already out there. The answer to that problem is found in community organizations around the country. I'm involved in one in DC called AOK. It started with this couple, Kathy and David, who had a kid in the DC public schools, and that kid had a friend who had no place to eat because his mom had some drug and health issues. So they said, well, James can come over and be with us. And then James had a friend and then had a friend. And when I started going to their home about 4 or 5 years ago, they had like 15 mattresses on the floor. And now they have a community of 45 young people, all who descend on their house at different times of the week. And it's just a big extended family. I walk in there the first time, I reach out to shake my hand, the hand of one of the kids, and he says, we don't shake hands here, we just hug here. I'm not a big hugger myself, but I have become one. And that's just building connection where there was none. I was with an organization called Thread in Baltimore. They take Baltimore kids, each kid gets 4 mentors, and then above that, there's 4 more who are called the grandparents. Then around that, there are all the other helpers. They just basically build a fabric of relationship around each kid. And because they all have phones, when one mentor or volunteer meets the kid, they can tell on their app when there's been a contact. And they call it the Fitbit of social relationships. They can measure when there's a contact, what kid has not been contacted, who's gone 2 hours without a contact. And so what we find around the country are people like this everywhere. I just had a meeting today with about six or eight people from Missoula, somebody from United Way, somebody doing refugee work, somebody doing artistic work, Indian work, all of whom knew each other well, all of whom are weavers in this community. And that's what's going to turn the country around. And what I notice about these people, they have moral motivation. We think people are selfish and that altruism is just off on the side of society. But what I see, it's at the center of society. It's what drives us, that yearning for purpose. They really believe in relationships and in vulnerability, that relationship is the agent of change. A friend of mine named Bill Milliken has been doing youth work for 50 years. He says, in all that time, I've never seen a program turn around a life. The only thing that turns around a life is relationship. Some of these people have what I think of as a hole in their soul. They had some wrong that they suffered, and now they're trying to fix society where their wrong happened. I know a guy in DC named Darius. When he was 9, his dad was killed. His dad had an affair with a stripper who arranged his murder. And so now Darius makes sure that young fatherless men have older men in their lives. They have walkout experiences. They leave the organization they would be part of, and they committed to one place. They are totally in love with their town. The woman who created Thread in Baltimore wears the map of Baltimore on a necklace around herself. The people here I met in Missoula are committed to their town. There was a young woman who said, I wanted to build here what people were leaving to get elsewhere. And so there's a ferocious attachment to place. There's radical mutuality. They have a sense that there's no such thing as haves and have-nots. We're all broken, and we're all working on this together. There's a philosophy of personalism, that you got to deal with the whole person, that when a kid comes to school, they don't leave their nutrition issues, their safety issues, their other issues behind. You have to deal with the whole human being. And so what I see in these people, most of all, is what I come to think of as vocational certitude. Every single one of them knows why they were put on Earth for. They all love what they're doing. It can be completely exhausting and they're under their rope. But they have their why solved. And it's inspiring to be around people who really have given their lives over to service. And when you're around those people, what you see is people who have a serenity that comes from knowing what you're doing what you should be doing, and a serenity and really a joy that comes from serving others. And when they talk about what propels them in this unrewarding work, it's always that joy. And so I'll end where I began, with the idea of the heart and soul. The idea that we all yearn for a fusion with another, and we yearn for some righteous cause. And when those things come together, it produces joy. I had a professor I was mentioning today who was in World War II, and when he marched with his men, he said, I lost sense of my own self. I felt a swelling out. I was part of the collective. And that was the most joyous feeling I ever had. Sometimes joy can be when we fuse with those we love. Dorothy Day, one of my heroes, she was about to give birth and she realized she'd read a lot of accounts of childbirth, but they were all written by men. So she thought she would write one. And she said, if I had painted the greatest painting, sculpted the greatest sculpture, or written the greatest symphony, I could not have felt the more exalted creator than I did when they placed my child in my arms. With such a vast flood of love and joy came a need to worship and to adore. And that was just the fusion with her new daughter. Parents, we've all had it. I remember once I was driving home from the news hour, and I pull into my driveway, and I can see in the backyard, and my kids, who were then 12, 9, and 4, were out in the backyard playing with a little plastic ball, kicking it up in the air. And they were just laughing and giggling and tumbling all over each other, chasing the ball and creating a little pile. And I just am confronted unexpectedly by this tableau of perfect family happiness. And I just stood there looking at it through the windshield, and it was one of those moments when life and time seem to spill over their boundaries, and you become aware of a joy that's you couldn't have earned. It's better than anything you ever get at work, and you sort of swell up, and you just want to try to be worthy of that joy out of a deep connection. But I think the higher part of joy comes when people are in unison serving some ideal, some common love. Rabbi Wolf Kellman described what it felt to march to Selma with Martin Luther King. He said, we felt connected in song to the transcendental, to the ineffable. We felt triumph and celebration. We felt that things change for the good and nothing is congealed forever. That was the warmest transcendental spiritual experience. Meaning and purpose and mission were beyond words. Meaning was the feeling, the song, the moment of overwhelming spiritual fulfillment. And that's what people get when they're really in deep relational community. They get that joy. David White, the poet, said, "Joy is a meeting place of deep intentionality and of self-forgetting. The bodily alchemy of what lies inside of us in communion with what formerly seemed outside but now is neither. Dance, laughter, affection, skin touching skin, singing in the car, music in the kitchen, the quiet, irreplaceable, and companionable presence of a daughter, the sheer intoxicating beauty of the world inhabiting at the edge of what we thought was us and was now is outside of us." That yearning for connection is what you see on the local level everywhere you go in this country. And somehow there's a phrase in the book of Job, and the sparks fly upward. Somehow those local sparks are going to fly upward. Somehow we're going to find a way to weave these local communities and these local deep relationships and have a new paradigm, a new attitude, which will be based on this idea of the whole person, based on the idea of putting relationship at the center, and it will eventually, I think, rebuild social trust and repair the country. Thank you. Now I've left time for questions. All I ask if you do ask questions is make them long, rambling, with no question at the end. Okay. Is opposition to immigration and refugees a natural consequence of tribalism, or are there other major factors that are responsible for turning toward nativism? So I would say it's a direct response. There are two mentalities you can have. One is a scarcity mentality, which is the idea that there's not much in the world and we're just a bunch of groups scrambling for the spoils. And the other is an abundance mentality, that we are ultimately descended from the Garden of Eden. There's plenty for all. Once you get the scarcity mentality based on people whipping up fear, then you get opposition to immigration and refugees. I sometimes want to write a column where I say, you know, I understand why people are opposed to immigration in this country. You know, embracing all this diversity, becoming a universal nation, doing basically what no other country has ever done, that's risky. And yet, when you look at the evidence for economically, immigrants fuel our economy, you look at work ethic, you look at faith, you look at criminality, immigrants are less criminal inclined than anything. It seems to me the evidence for maintaining our status as an immigrant-friendly nation are just overwhelming. And we will just have to find a way to figure out how to live together across diversity. When I go around the country for Weave, I have this interesting phenomenon which I really don't know what to make sense of. I meet in the daytime with community builders, and they are buoyant. And then at night, get together with citizens of the towns, usually at about 25 at a time. Then they start talking about the system as a whole. And there's anger, fury, alienation, and the mood gets really dark. And both these realities are existing in America today. The hopeful building, communities are built by two things. They're built by a common story, and two, by a project they do together. And these people have a common story for their towns, who we are, and then they're building projects together, whether it's to do the arts, as here, settle refugees, to help kids graduate. But then the anger and the desire for systemic change is massive. And so the trick is to take the core of what we know does change people, which is social relationship, and do it on a larger scale. Finding a way to do that, I think it was best exemplified by what I saw here today, which they call collective impact strategies, where I went into the office across the street at the bar, up in the green room up there, and I met with a business person, with a United Way person, with political people. If you get all the people creating a system of relationship that can focus on social problems, then you've created something systemic and also something relational.
Can you comment on the abandonment of conservative principles by the conservative movement over the past 50 years?
Yeah. I mentioned I went to the University of Chicago, and I was then a socialist. If you go online, my first TV appearance, I was a socialist, and I was hired by PBS to debate Milton Friedman. And you can see it, I've got a lot of hair and very big glasses. And basically, it's me summarizing some socialistic argument and him destroying it in 6 words. And then the camera lingering on my face for 19 or 20 seconds while I try to think of something to say. But I did read a book in college called The Reflections on the Revolution of France by Edmund Burke. And I hated that book. I wrote a bunch of papers about what an evil guy this was. Because I wanted revolution, I wanted to think for myself, and he said, be careful on what you think you know. The world is complicated. Everything should be incremental. You should show respect for existing institutions. And I hated that. And then I went to become a police reporter, and I covered a place called Cabrini Green, public housing projects in Chicago. And these were housing projects designed by sociologists and others with the best of intentions to tear down old neighborhoods and put up these nice big brick buildings. But when they tore down the old neighborhoods, they tore out the communities, and the brick buildings became horrible. Physically better, but socially much worse. It was an evil effect of good intentions. And I said, well, maybe that guy, Edmund Burke, was right. That doing social change is super hard and complicated, and we should proceed incrementally. And while I was at college, I wrote I was a humor columnist at school paper, and a guy named William F. Buckley came to campus. And I wrote a parody of him for being a name-dropping blowhard. And I said, he comes into rooms and makes everybody else feel inferior. His party trick is to turn water into wine. He started 2 magazines at Yale, one called the National Buckley, one called the Buckley Review, which he merged to form the Buckley Buckley. And it was kind of mean. But he, at the end of his speech, he said, David Brooks, if you're in the audience, I want to give you a job. And I wasn't in the audience, but 3 years later, I called him. And he became my mentor for 18 months. And I entered the conservative movement. And it was based on Burkean conservatism, respect for the past, respect for community, a belief that politics is a limited activity, that the most important things in our lives are not politics, it's our character, it's our relationships, it's the people we love. And it was a really cohesive community when I entered it in the 80s. And I think it did a lot of good things. I think it helped hasten the end of the Cold War. I think it re-energized this country. And since 1995, I've seen it slide gradually away from anything I recognize. And now it's the opposite. I mean, when you have the Gingrich Revolution, how could you have a conservative revolution? Conservatives are not revolutionaries. It fell in love with the market. It fell in love with individualism. And it just walked away. And then, in the last 2 years, the other thing you conservatives are supposed to believe is that mores are more important than laws, that character is more important than politics. And you've watched a group of people flip those beliefs completely. And it's been a stunning thing for me. I have a friend who served in 3 Republican administrations, and he said, I used to have 2 identity markers. I'm an evangelical Christian, and I'm a Republican. Now I'm not sure I can say either of those things. So it has been a shocking period, made only more shocking by the fact that so many of my friends are not shocked. And I'm being honest and riffing here, but it's been an amazing period in American history and American life. And I think the only thing we can say is that one thing Trump understood is that we were not having the liberal conservative argument anymore. That was over the size of the state, socialism versus capitalism. That was the market versus the state. But he understood that the argument has changed. It's not that, it's now it's just open, closed. If you have the tailwinds of globalization and the meritocracy pushing behind you, you're for open borders, open trade, open social mores. If you're getting blasted in the face by those things, you want to close borders, close social mores, build walls. And he spoke to that. And so the credit that he deserves credit for is understanding what debate we have. And a lot of us didn't see that coming. The second thing is that there are certain people who are not good at builders, but they're good at destroying corrupt old systems. In the 1960s, there was a guy named Abby Hoffman. Some of you may remember. He was not a great strategist, but he was good at theater. And he would put on these spectacles that poked holes in the old system. At one level, he's more than this, but Donald Trump is our Abby Hoffman. He's theatrical, and he pokes holes in things. Along the way, he divides. Every sore spot in our country divides. But I guess the final thing to say is one of the revelations for me is loyalty to team trumps loyalty to ideas. And I think that's what we're seeing. And a lot of my friends and I were sort of conservative, never Trumpers. We don't know where we'll go. It's a very mystifying period. We spent a lot of time talking about this, about what will happen. I'm not for Elizabeth Warren. I don't agree with her. So where's the home? And so homeless.
In this chaotic time, how do we as individuals reach across the aisle when there's such a divide?
So I was at a Nationals game, a Washington Nationals baseball. Top of the ninth inning, a guy turned to me and said, "Are you David Brooks?" And I said, "Yeah." And I was hoping for some nice words of compliments. And I won't say the exact words he said. And I was, it happens from time to time. And then my son, who was with me, leapt in, and he attacked him. "You should be ashamed of that man, it's your father." And then my wife leapt in, and he attacked her. He just was screaming at me. I thought a lot of, in retrospect, you think, well, how do you handle that situation? And I think the only wise answer is love your enemy. That the reason people are like that is, A, they don't think you're a human being. B, they feel disrespected. The right answer in those situations is to say, "Okay, let me get you a beer and I'll hear you out." I've found when somebody sends me super nasty email, if I wrote them back and saying, "Well, thanks for writing," and they realize there's another human being, they're having a communicative exchange, then they turn nice right away. And so some people are truly evil and they won't, but I've come to the conclusion you just have to love them back. Martin Luther King was a genius at this. He wrote about this all the time. If you try to build a wall of hate against me, I'll widen my circle to embrace you. I think that's the only right answer. Having said that, when he's shouting at me in front of my wife and kid, I did not take that strategy. But I regret it. But, I spent a lot of time thinking about how do countries turn around in times like this. And the best example is the 1890s to 1910. There was a period of economic transition, massive wave of immigration, political corruption. So three things happened. First is a religious revival. The social gospel movement replaced the social Darwinism, which justified selfishness. Second, the civic revival. You had the creation of the Boys and Girls Clubs, the Settlement House, the environmental movement, the temperance movement, the NAACP, the unions, they all came into being. And then a political revival. The progressive movement. So it went religious, civic, political. Today, I'm not sure there's a religious revival, but the ethos these community builders have based on personalism and deep relationality, there's a philosophy in there. The civic revival is happening all around us. So these things will I think, bind us back together. The political revival, good luck with that. But the answer to that is localism. It's devolving power out of Washington and back to the cities. I always ask people, what identity do you care most about? Your town, your state, your nation, or the world? And for me, frankly, it's nation. I care more about nation. For John McCain, it was nation. He cared more about nation than he did about Arizona. For most people I meet, it's town. They love Houston, they love Missoula, they love Baltimore. And you are only going to really throw yourself into a community that you absolutely love. And so to me, the way to get out of the political morass is to just get under it to the local level.
What do you make of the current Russia situation?
I covered the fall of the Soviet Union, as I mentioned, and the birth of Russia. I loved it because with the Russians, it's never a political problem, it's never an economic problem, it's always the Russian soul. And so you have to go to somebody's house and interview at 5 p.m., they start serving vodka, the lights go dark, you're sitting in the dark, and they're talking morosely about the Russian soul. And I actually loved that, that was fun. But the thing you would notice when you go into Russian apartments is that the apartments were nice, but you'd step out into the vestibules and they would reek of urine, the lights would be out, they hadn't been cleaned in years. And you would say to the Russians, you know, there are only four apartments around this vestibule, why don't you get together and clean it? And they would say, well, so-and-so's a drunk, so-and-so I don't like. But the real reason was, after 70 years of totalitarianism, they didn't know who was KGB, and so there was no social trust. It's the least trusting society I've ever been in. And so what happened when the Soviet Union fell, instead of working together, they basically stole everything. Everything was stolen. It's a sign of what happens to society when there's a lack of social trust. And we're gradually, not to that extent, but gradually heading in that direction. And when there's no social trust, you do not have the fabric to hold up a democracy. You have to have some basic level of mutuality to have a democracy or to have capitalism. And they didn't have the underworkings. And we've learned the hard way over the last 25 years, you really have to have the nest to have a democracy. And if the nest isn't there, the democracy can't function because it's based on some set of relationships. And so what Vladimir Putin, the arrival of him, seems almost like sociologically determined. He happens to be a particularly ruthless dictator. My favorite story about him, do people know the Bob Kraft Super Bowl ring story? I'll tell that, I found it indicative. Bob Kraft is the owner of the New England Patriots. He went to delegation and visited Putin, and he was wearing his Super Bowl ring, which he got from being owner of this team. And Putin said, oh, I like your ring. Can I see it? So he took it off and gave it to Putin, and Putin was dangling it through the meeting and was wearing it. And then as the meeting progressed, Putin took the ring and put it into his pocket. Kraft, after the meeting, went to one of the American diplomats, said, hey, listen, I didn't want to make a big display, but can you just go get Putin my ring? That means a lot to me. I'd be happy to make him a replica, another ring. So they went to the Kremlin, and they said to the Russians, you know, we'd like the ring back, we'll make you a new one. And they came back to Kraft and said, we're going to write up a press release that you've decided to donate that ring to the Russian people because he's not giving it back. And so what you learn from that is the world is run by four-year-olds. But it's a dog-eat-dog world in some people's mindset. I think the breakdown of that society just had such deep social roots. It's got some of the greatest people on earth in Russia, and some of the worst. It will just be a continuing menace. And the larger lesson for American policy is the same message when you're clearing weeds. You gotta keep clearing them. If you don't keep clearing them, they grow back. And America has withdrawn inward, and a lot of the wolves around the world are just emboldened by that, most especially him.
How worried should we be about the future of American democracy?
We should be a little worried. I think some of the problems that worry me most, one, loss of love of country. I was raised by my grandfather, was an immigrant ethos. And coming to America and being in this country was just winning the biggest lottery ticket on earth. You know, I'm out here and, you know, we were Jews on the Lower East Side. But one of my uncles was a guy named Irving Browning. And Irving Browning was an actor in the silent movie era, and then he became a director. He directed Westerns. And so if you went to his apartment in Manhattan, it looked like you were in Montana in 1860. He had like powder horns, he had saddles, he had chaps, he had lassos, he had big cowboy hats, he had Custer's rifle or whatever it was. The odd thing about him, you really felt like you were in Montana, just pictures everywhere, memorabilia everywhere. Irving Browning never himself went west of the Hudson River in his life. But he had a vision of what America was, and it was an idealized vision of the West. But a lot of immigrants came here, like the song Yankee Doodle Dandy was written by Isaiah Berlin, Irving Berlin, sorry, wrong Berlin, as an imagined of what the West was like, of what America was like. If you go back to the early 17th century or 18th century, and you look at the diaries of the people who were coming out west to settle, they would write the diaries of what it was going to be like in Wyoming and Arizona and Montana. And the diaries, they're imagining New England small towns. They have no idea what they're getting themselves into. And so they're living in the future in this optimistic way. There's a novel set in, I think, South Dakota called The Giants of the Earth. And a farmer is showing a visitor to his farm. The farmer says, well, there's my barn, these are my outbuildings, here's my fields. And the visitor says, well, I don't really see anything. And the farmer says, well, I haven't built them yet, but they'll be there. And what I'm trying to say is, we have always been this imaginative nation, and always with a future-oriented mentality where the future seems more real than the present. And as a result of this fevered activity, this sense of promised land, we've moved around more, we've started businesses more, we marry and divorce more, we kill each other more. We're just a fevered, dynamic country. One of my big fears is that we're losing a little of that dynamism. One of the oddities right now is that mobility, moving from place to place, is plummeting. And young people are moving much less. Starting new business rates are plummeting. Somehow that vibrant energy, sometimes I get a sense it's diminished. If we have energy, we can solve anything. But a reduced country, you'd sort of just settle. And I do worry about that a little. The only remedy to say is, if you read Tocqueville came here in the 1830s. And he described a certain sort of American ethos. It's ups and it's downs. And basically the ethos he described is still America. That we just have this advantage of having a certain unique culture that makes us sometimes shallow, sometimes dangerous, but always super hopeful. And I have to feel that cultural continuity, the presence of the past, is going to drive us hopefully into the future. But no other country quite has the sense of the American dream, the American story, the American narrative, the American hopefulness that our future is really out there waiting to be seized. Somehow I think it'll just take a leader and it'll take the grassroots.
How do we address global questions where there's denial of basic scientific underpinnings, such as climate change?
Yeah, I think this is actually one of the hardest things of the current moment. I was with a bunch of economists recently. They had served in previous administrations, Republican and Democratic administrations. They're economists, so they believe in facts, they believe in data, they believe in truth-seeking. They said, does any of that matter anymore? And it doesn't seem to. One of the questions, the debates I have with my friends is Donald Trump mostly a Twitter feed, or is he actually running the government? And I think the answer is that he's mostly a Twitter feed. Now, with that Twitter feed, he can do enormous damage, in my view, to our cultural norms, to our moral norms, our political norms. But there's no hint of a legislative agenda in the White House. There's no hint of actually doing stuff. Now, that's bad enough. But it's not like, frankly, it's not like Putin, who's super effective. That part of this moment, I think, will pass. And hopefully when the change comes, it'll be, if he does lose the election, it'll be fascinating to see how the Trump supporters react, with anger or with dismissal. And you have to think the odds are on dismissal. One of the things you notice about people in the Trump White House is how quick they are to turn on the president. There's no sense of loyalty, no sense of affection. Usually when you go to a White House, I've covered presidents since Reagan, everybody has the super biggest crush on the president. I once interviewed a guy who it was during the Obama administration, and he had an office that looked over the South Lawn of the White House, and Obama was leaving the White House to get on a helicopter to go somewhere. And the guy interrupted the interview and just stood by the window and watched the president's back walk away. And it was like a look of glowing love came over him. It's like the biggest crush ever. Then he sat down with me again, and we conducted the interview. But there's none of that in this White House. One of the White House staffers in this White House said to me, did other administrations have a sense of camaraderie? Because we have none of that. And that's the basic truth. I don't think there's going to be much shared affection when he's no longer the figurehead or useful in some psychic way.
Well, we wish we could keep asking you questions all night, but this will be the final one. Can the American two-party system survive as currently constituted?
I for all my life, I've been a person who didn't believe in third parties, just because it's super hard to do. But I will say one thing that I hope is true. There are two parties, but there are three political traditions in American history. There's a conservative tradition that believes in reducing government to enhance freedom and liberty. There's a liberal tradition that believes in using government to enhance equality and social justice. But there's a third tradition that started out with my hero, Alexander Hamilton, who, as I mentioned earlier, is a Puerto Rican hip-hop star from New York. And his tradition is limited but energetic government to enhance social mobility. He created a system of government, using government in limited ways to give poor boys and girls like him a chance to succeed. And that tradition, after Hamilton died, was picked up by the Whig Party. And the Whigs were always building railroads and canals, and they had banks to invest. It was picked up by Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln actually gave more speeches about banking than he did about slavery over the course of his career. And it was picked up by the Republican Party in the Civil War era, and they did the Land Grant College Act, the Homestead Act, the railroad legislation, all to give opportunity to poor boys and girls. Then it was picked up by Teddy Roosevelt. And then it died. And yet that tradition, I think, is still out there in the country. And all it lacks is a political institution to carry it forward. I happen to be in that tradition. I'm a Whig. I'm living in the 1850s. But it is, I think it is an answer to a lot of the problems of our day, that we do need some third party. The only problem is there's an ethos of radicalism in the country today, and a third party has to be the most radical party out there, not radical left, not radical right, but radical down. Down into relationship, down into local community, down into this municipal government. And say, we are in the middle of a big power renegotiation in this society. And that we have to radically think the ways we build civic architecture. And we have to discover, I'll come back to where I started, this idea that we're all whole people who long for relationship, who long for righteousness. And we have to harness that activity. One of the worst things that's happened is the way we think about politics, that it's a competition between self-interest. That whether it's the Constitution or capitalism, society does not require good people. That you can harness selfishness for good ends. That seems to me fundamentally wrong, a fundamental misjudgment. And so society does require good people who are trusting of each other, who are honest with each other, who respect facts, and we're learning that lesson. And my hope is we will learn that lesson, and we'll focus much more on the formation of our citizens and the formation of our souls than just on the manipulation of our interests. We live in a society that is over-politicized and under-moralized. We talk on TV about every little poll, every little political scandal, but we barely talk about how relationships are formed, how forgiveness works, how to turn moments of suffering into moments of learning. These are actually the big questions of life. And I've made it my vocation in the last, whatever, 50 or 60 more years I have, to try to shift the debate a little over, away from politics, toward these other issues, these deeper issues of relationship and moral formation. And I've tried to bring that tonight here. And thank you so much for listening.
That was commentator and author David Brooks with The Cultural Revolution We Need. Brooks spoke as part of the University of Montana's President's Lecture Series at the Wilma Theater on September 10th, 2018. Thanks to UM Professor Rob Saldin and to Lane McKay and Isaac McKeldery from Logjam Presents. I'm Bo Baker. If you missed part of this talk, you can find it on our website, mtpr.org.